sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Banking crisis renewed. Markets volatile as headlines hit. Oil surges as OPEC news has shorts covering. And an update on Las Vegas. All this and much more on episode number 478 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you, and this is Andrew Horowitz. And you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. September is now over in the record books. And we see that we had a rather volatile month, of course, as we saw all sorts of news hitting the tapes. Now, you may wonder, gosh, Andrew, you sound kind of under the weather or something. Well, that's true. I have a little bit of a cold. But I'm also just off of a red eye back from Las Vegas. I thought the first thing I would do was get to the office because the airport's pretty close to my office. And I took an Uber, got here, and thought I'd share a bit of the information that I gleaned from my quick visit over the weekend to Las Vegas. You see, my son turned 21 just last week, and he was out there actually for a conference doing some work for a business that he's working on. And he said, you know, I'm going to be spending a couple days out there. And I said, oh, wait a minute. You're going to be out there for a few days. You know what? I'll meet you there for the weekend. So took a flight out there, spent some time, and stayed at the Mirage, actually. And we had a great time together. Went to a variety of the hotels because I wanted to. He's in the hospitality area. So I wanted to go to the hotels and see what those are all about. Some of the ones that I haven't seen in years. Some of the ones that I've never seen. So I walked down the strip and went to Caesars, took the grand tour of Caesars. We actually have some people we know over there that work at Caesars. And actually, Peter met us over there and took us for the tour. But just a beautiful, incredible property. Gigantic if you haven't been there. And then on top of that, we went to the Bellagio. We went to Encore, the Wynn, MGM Grand, Paris, Vegas, and went to New York, and the new Cosmopolitan. I got to tell you something. First of all, if you haven't had the opportunity to be in Vegas, make sure a few things. First of all, you have to look at some of these hotels. They're absolutely beautiful. Some a little bit more than others. Some are old, and they keep them in great condition. But some of them are just beautiful. Brand new, state of the art. Not only the casino floors, but the rooms, etc. The Wynn by far. We had the afternoon lunch buffet there because everybody said, you have to go to Caesars. You have to go to Wynn for the buffet. So we said, okay, we'll go. So we went to Wynn for the lunch. Man, that was absolutely spectacular. Not only was the actual facility where you have lunch just beautiful with fresh flowers and incredible and ornate overall structures inside of the area where you eat lunch, but the buffet was, it went on for miles and miles and miles and miles. And then they keep them putting more food out and the seafood and the meats and the carving stations and the desserts and the candy apples and the list goes on. Let me tell you something. Really a great deal. Now, what did I learn? A couple things. I always ask, you know, the drivers that take us and the people at the desk, you know, what's happening out here? What's going on? I haven't been here for a number of years. What's new? And they tell me that Vegas is very strong. Not only do we have a lot of conventions going on right now, but we have a lot of visitors, a lot of foreign visitors, and people are spending money. It's not the high season right now for Vegas, but generally speaking, everyone I spoke to had a positive comment in terms of what was going on. It's been really renewed over the last decade. Went from you know, a gambler's paradise, adult only, Sin City, to a family destination. That family destination theme, that idea that somebody came up with, pretty much was taken back saying, you know what, let's face it, it's not a family destination. There are some things to do for kids here and there, but we're not going to make it a family destination. Went back to more of a entertainment capital with shows, pool parties that are amazing, major talent in terms of the DJs they bring to the pools. The cost, we went actually to the Mirage Pool to reserve a chair or to sit in a chair, a lounge chair. It's $100 minimum spend on, you know, any kind of alcohol or food, whatever, per chair, per person. If you want to rent a cabana, it's $1,500. And if you want to have just a simple table, it's about $400. These are spends that you have to have. And the prices actually escalate from there. They have bottle service. They have food, et cetera. And everything is probably about four or five times the actual price of what it should be. But, okay, you're in a hotel. Fine. You're in Vegas. All right. Yeah, I get that. And then you're at the quote-unquote exclusive pool, you know, where they also charge you, if you're not a guest or not a player or whatever, they charge you an extra added surcharge even to go to some of the more private pools on the facility grounds. So Vegas was kind of cool. Played some poker, won some money at blackjack, lost some money at blackjack, kind of held my own. We had a great time overall. Saw didn't go to any of the shows this time around. There wasn't enough time, but did go to the the Neon Sign Museum. It's a junkyard of all the old signs that you saw many years ago. You know, the billboards and the signs that you saw on the Strip, the Stardust, and you know, things that you haven't seen in years that maybe the signs they were going to just get rid of, or maybe they changed signs, they upgraded the signs. Great place to visit. And of course, downtown on Fremont Street, they really revitalized the entire old Strip. That was a lot of fun. That's probably one of the highlights of going to Vegas. Not only is the Strip really cool with all the magnificent hotels, but downtown on Fremont, there's a party going on all the time. So really cool place to be. I encourage you, if you haven't gone in the past, it's something you really need to go visit for a few days at least and see what's going on there. And of course, I've seen a lot of shows in the past, but some of the new shows look pretty amazing. I mean, there's a lot. The one thing that was weird was there's a lot of this Cirque du Soleil going on. As a matter of fact, there's too much of the Cirque du Soleil going on. The the MGM properties have all of these Cirque du Soleils, and you know, the different ones with the Beatles, one's called O, which is a water show. There's a few other different ones. Probably, I think there's like five of them. I think I counted five in Vegas. Seems like too much. Anyway, let's move on, talk about a few other things that are going on. Keeping it to a short show, we have the Jewish holidays happening this week. Oftentimes that is a time when volumes are a little bit lower than average. And of course, we did see last week a lot of volatility. And some are blaming that on the Deutsche Bank situation, where if you recall, Deutsche Bank was down probably about 45% this year alone on all the different problems that they were having. There was some speculation that the bank is having difficulty, just like many of the European banks, due to negative interest rates. Well, that was kind of weighing on the shares for some time. Yield curve was not cooperative. They had some internal issues as well. And then we saw that the U.S. has been put a fine against them, about $14 billion. Well, that kind of, you know, tilted the cart pretty well and caused a lot of people to start moving out. Then we saw stories that there was a lot of hedge funds and institutions actually pulling their money and withdrawing their accounts from Deutsche Bank. On top of that, we saw last week the CEO of and chairman of the board of Deutsche Bank come out and say that, well, everything's fine. We're, you know, well capitalized, not to worry about anything. And that really jogged the memory of a lot of people back to the days of Lehman, when Dick Fuld was saying at the time, just on the precipice of their default and bankruptcy, don't worry, we're well capitalized, everything is fine. And I think there were some parallels drawn there, and people got a little spooked, saying, wait a minute, you know, hold on. You have you know, Merkel saying one thing and the ECB saying another thing, and you have the reality of the shares doing another thing. You see these news items about withdrawals happening. And so what happened was that, you know, that started falling throughout the week. And then on Thursday – there was another big slam down on the news that there was all these withdrawals happening. That really shook markets because Deutsche Bank controls a significant amount of wealth. And on top of that, one of the key anchor financial institutions in Europe. And if Deutsche Bank is having trouble, think about how bad things must be otherwise. Now, on Friday, there was some news once again on the other side saying that, oh, good news. Deutsche Bank has reached some kind of an agreement on the fine that the U.S. put against them, and there's some kind of something happening. They're going to clean this up and get done with this. Everybody was happy. Now, after hours, as a matter of fact, on Saturday, a new piece of information came to light where the Italian government is now suing Deutsche Bank for some of the, as they say, the wrongdoings during the financial crisis, in particular with what they did to their key bank, Monte Paschi, I believe is how you pronounce it. And we'll see how that plays next week. But, you know, you're starting to see it from all ends here. It looks like some of the players are looking to strike while they can because they want to make sure to get ahead of any other problems that are going to be coming in, other lawsuits, other maybe fines from governments. And if, in fact, there was some success by the U.S. government in fining them for some of their actions during the financial crisis, well, maybe Italy is saying, hey, you know what? We're going to go after them, too. So this is going to be an ongoing saga. I don't think the ECB helped at all with pushing rates so into the negative territory. And even though they are the buyers of some of these corporate bonds and some of the sovereign wealth and maybe even not directly on some of these areas, but they are indirectly buyers of the debt. And that was helpful in propping up the debt and helpful in maybe, in fact, elevating the prices to make it look like things were not as problematic as they were. The truth of the matter is we see that in the stock price, clearly, not just recently, but over the last year or so, things are not going so well for them. So keep that in mind for next week. That's going to be a very interesting, just, you know, not only from the stock price and what happens with Deutsche Bank, but I think the entire process is going to be under question about what the ECB has done in terms of their stimulus programs, their quantitative easing, their negative interest rates. I think that whole model is going to come into very significant question and probably bleed over to any other countries that have implemented negative interest rates, and the key one being Japan, of course. Because if their banks in Europe can't withstand this pressure of the negative interest rates, why should the Japanese banks? And that, unfortunately, they've gone too far, these central banks, with pushing things to the limit to a place that nobody really has any experience. Now let's kind of flip over for a second to oil. We saw a lot of news, just a tremendous amount of news headlines throughout the week, and probably, I guess, beginning last week, with this whole idea that maybe there's finally going to be some kind of an agreement with OPEC and non-OPEC countries with their oil production, a freeze or some kind of something to help stabilize the price of oil. And we saw a variety of different ones, announcements come out this week. The one that really started to take hold and cause for a significant surge in the price of oil was when OPEC said, yes, in fact, we did reach some kind of a tentative or an agreement that we're going to actually cut production or stabilize it, freeze it by about 300 plus thousand barrels per day starting in November. Now, they also said that, well, we don't really have a plan in place. We don't have exact details of how we're going to do this. We don't know what countries will actually cut, but this is what we're going to do. And for whatever reason, they said that the details will be announced during their November meeting. And I guess what they were doing here is just biding time, because if they don't have a plan, they don't really have anything more than a general framework, which we still don't know if there's a full agreement to all this, even though they say there's been some kind of agreement. We don't think it's been written down and said, oh, this is what's going to happen. And then by them saying we're going to announce it in November, think about that. In November, we're talking about, you know, a month and a half till they say anything. So in fact, you can't really bet against it if you're a short player. And I think this was just a way of trying to stabilize it and do something out of desperation in the short term and really get to the short sellers and probably try what they can do behind the scenes to prop up prices with not only commentary, but also with possibly, you know, propping up and buying some of the futures, et cetera, themselves. Make it look like there's something very significant happening here. Now, we still know, of course, that in the end, there's still a supply glut. Demand is down significantly. And 300,000 or so barrels per day doesn't really make for a very significant amount. It's a very small amount in the overall daily production that goes on. And truthfully, as prices start moving higher, you will see a lot more rigs coming online in the U.S. and other areas, and that will probably push it. So we see some of that 300,000 barrel cut that they've been talking about, it'll be filled by other players out there. So keep a watch on oil, because that's another thing that will probably move markets a bit, as many companies are affected by the price of oil as well as the profitability of oil for in the energy sector. So that's something I think that we should keep a very close watch on. That and the banking crisis that's brewing. Again, I think we've talked about this so many times that in the U.S., there's a whole different structure and process that was put in place to recapitalize the banks and to really get their balance sheets in good order. Much different than went on, let's say, in Europe. Europe just sugarcoated everything. And they said, everything, look how great everything looks. They put like a coating of over the top of everything. But down below and underneath is still that giant sinkhole. And if the top ever saw a crack, that's where the problems start, because there's nothing underneath it really that has any quality. Versus what we did here in the U.S. for the most part was fix the banks, or at least create some regulation, recapitalize them, and do a lot of work to actually get them to a much better place. So overall, big difference there. I don't know what impact, let's just say, and hypothetically, way out there saying, if Deutsche Bank does fail or something does happen and very significantly to Deutsche Bank, does that just lead to a further strengthening of our banks here, as many of the players realize that the things that happened in Europe are not working, and the way that the ECB went at fixing the situation was nothing more than just a patch? And does that help our banks here and our financial institutions here, because they'll win over all of those assets or many of them? Or, on the other hand, will we see that there will be a knock-on effect? I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, because it's a much different circumstance that happened back in the mid-2000s, because that was a global epidemic of bad loan and just all sorts of things that happened that were just really set up to fail. This is much different. It may be much more isolated. So we'll see what happens with that. Moving along to something else I wanted to just talk about just briefly. I'm going to keep this to a short show, not only because I was on the red eye and probably have less than 2 hours of sleep, and I'm still working off this cold that I got last week. But we have this shortened week coming up not fully short, but it's a Jewish holidays. And like I said, during that time, there is a lot of traders that are off, but also there's some, lower volume. But we're going to keep this show short this week. I'm going to ask for a little bit of reprieve due to my vacation schedule and the effects of being in Vegas and just having a great time all weekend. But give me credit for coming in here with a couple hours sleep early in the morning on a Sunday to talk about some of these things. I want to talk about what was really interesting about the debate that we saw. And you may have heard me talk about this on DH Unplugged with John Dvorak last week. It was really fascinating, I thought, to watch during the debate, where the debate started, and into the debate, the Mexican peso and the yen, but the Mexican peso in particular, were having some very funky action. And as the debate progressed, and I guess how the metrics came out during the debate after the first 10 minutes or so, was that, Trump wasn't as strong, at least I'm talking to you and saying this through the eyes of the Mexican peso. Because what happened was that as the debate progressed throughout the entire evening, the Mexican peso started to gain significantly. I mean, I'm not talking about just a little bit. I'm talking about this thing was powering higher. I mean, really scooting higher. Now, before the debate, as Trump was gaining in the polls, the peso started dropping. And why? Well, why? Because if, in fact, Trump would continue to gain in the polls and his idea of holding back immigration, redoing all these trade deals, putting up a wall, and really focusing on Mexico in many of his discussions and many of his various speeches, if that was to play out, well, that's not good for Mexico. But what was really kind of key, I thought, was how the Mexican peso rallied almost 2% during the 90 minutes of Trump's presentation or the debate. Now, whether or not you're a Republican or a Democrat or undecided or liberal or communist, I don't care what you are, but it was really interesting to use this as a kind of a playbook to really see how markets are reacting and what is going to be the reaction for, let's say, a Trump presidency or a Clinton presidency. Because clearly two things happened. As the Mexican peso started to rise significantly, we also saw the U.S. futures rising. And that can tell you that there's two things that the markets are thinking. One, that obviously if Trump is elected to president, there is some concern over many of the countries around the world outside the U.S. and some of the things that may happen, at least from his current discussions and his current tact of how he's going to handle things, renewing these trade or pulling these trade deals, and who knows what he's going to do with bonds and the treasuries, renegotiate those possibly, give some haircuts, who knows? But these are the things that he's talking about. And you can see who is actually leading and what the markets think. And right now what the markets think at this point is, and after the debate, is that, well, at that point, Trump was not as strong. Therefore, the Mexican peso started to rise and the markets continued to rise. So therefore, we can extrapolate from that very simply that the market prefers Clinton. Again, this is not a political statement. This is a fact. At least what we could see from the action of the markets, because the S&P futures by the end of the presentations was up like 13 or 14 points, came back a little bit in the morning, kind of rallied a little bit more during the regular session and kind of closed about, I think it was up, I don't know, 0.5% or so, 0.75%. But that was clearly an indication of how markets perceive what's going to happen if either one of the people are elected. Now, some have been calling for a total market decimation, a crash of epic proportions if Donald Trump becomes president. I don't know. I'm just following along the bouncing ball here of what markets are telling us. We do know that as Trump has risen in the polls, there's been a seesawing effect on markets. And again, into the debate, we saw that big move. And as Clinton has been moving up in the polls, we saw markets again seesawing a little bit more to the upside. So again, not a political discussion. I'm just reading the tea leaves as they are coming at us with respect to market views. And I can only view that in terms of price. I can only view it as, and that's how you should do it too. What are the prices of things telling us during key moments leading up until this election? Do I think that if Trump becomes president, there's going to be an all-out market crash? I don't think so. Because don't forget that he's president, but he's part of a three-part governmental process, generally speaking. He can't just put in laws to put up a wall in Mexico and then just say that Mexico is going to pay for it without any kind of a plan, without any kind of agreement by Congress, etc. And, of course, Hillary Clinton can't just simply bash the biotechs and, you know, put in laws that may change things without the agreement of Congress either. Now, some of her things are a little less radical, although, and by the way, much more, I guess, much more palatable by the consumer, because the end product is that, oh yeah. You know, you're going to have healthcare. Those damn healthcare companies are really killing us. They're charging us too much for this. They're charging us too much for that. My premium is up at this level, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I say, well, that makes sense. I can't argue with that. Now, I could probably argue with this whole question of, or at least not have as strong of an opinion about a redoing of a trade agreement, putting a wall up, you know, maybe. But some of the other things on the other side, because it seems that it's much more populist oriented and my pocketbook oriented with some of the things that Hillary Clinton is doing. Again, make sure you're clear. I am not taking sides here. I'm just talking about how markets are perceiving this. So keep a watch on that. It's very interesting if you want to follow certain things like the peso, the yen, and the, let's say, the equity futures to see, you know, during different speeches or, for example, certain areas of the markets like Hillary Clinton has talked about very significantly having major regulation restrictions and pricing halts on any kind of increases from drug companies, et cetera. Watch the biotechs. That's something you want to watch. On the other side with Trump, you want to watch Mexico and foreign countries that have trade deals with us and how that plays out, their bonds maybe, their currencies, and their markets. So I think that's kind of how you look at this whole thing, and you can, in a way, benchmark what markets are are thinking and what's going to play out. So anyway, all right, we're gonna end it there. I'm exhausted. I'm just exhausted. Going to get some sleep, and we'll pick it up next week. I know we did have a guest booked for next week, an author. I know. You know what? I'll also get to some of these questions because I'm getting a little bit backed up and piled up. I have about 6 or 7 questions here on different things that have been sent to me. I have, let's see, Oliver sent me something, Robert G, Ryan S, Fred R. So we got lots of little things to talk about, answer some questions. If you have any questions, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's a little button on top there that says Ask Andrew. Send me your question. We'll answer it in an upcoming episode, or I'll answer you directly. Either way, hopefully we'll get to the bottom of your question and give you an answer that makes some sense and helps you along. I want to thank you for joining me. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged every week. For everybody that's celebrating the Jewish New Year, have a happy and a healthy, and we'll talk again next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.